Edward Snowden rocks South by Southwest. Today, Monday, March 10th. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. The global tech crowd in Austin embraces NSA leaker Edward Snowden as he appeared via video link from Moscow.
There was even cheers at some points. A very supportive crowd.
We'll hear what Snowden had to say at South by Southwest. Also today, the 19th century Ukrainian poet Taras Shevchenko and how he's remembered today.
He became a symbol for the desire to be free for the whole of Ukraine.
And later, how a journalist helped a pastor and an imam in Nigeria begin to reconcile.
He was a respected figure, and he said to both of them, "You two alone can stop the violence here. You need to talk to each other." And he just walked away.
Now those two men, who were once enemies, are working together to try and end religious violence in Nigeria.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, searching for runners who benefit from medical technology to run in the Medtronic Twin Cities Marathon or Medtronic 10-Mile Run. Application and information available at medtronic.com/globalheroes.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. The biggest event today at the South by Southwest Conference didn't involve a band, but it did involve a rock star. Okay, a rock star in the digital world, anyway. South by Southwest is not just a music festival. It's also an interactive venue to discuss the latest in tech. And that's why former NSA contractor Edward Snowden made an appearance today via a video link from Russia. He spoke on a panel about privacy, moderated by the American Civil Liberties Union. And behind him, on the screen, an image of the U.S. Constitution. The World's Stephen Davey was there and filled me in on the mood in Austin.
Marco, I have to say, Snowden is just taking over, or rather, he took over all of Austin this morning. So Snowden was simulcast into one of the largest, in fact, the largest conference room, the exhibition hall, which has bleachers and has rows and rows and rows of seats, probably, I'd guess, 1,000 people in that room. And he was also simulcast in two other ballrooms about half that size, and then in a few breakout rooms. So it was very Snowden this morning in Austin.
Yeah, for at least a couple of thousand people. And age-wise, I know South by Southwest tends to skew pretty young anyway, but I suppose this didn't disappoint in terms of numbers. Pretty young, the crowd?
Yeah, I'd say you're dead on there. It was interesting, you know, when it was announced by the ACLU that Snowden was going to be speaking at South by Southwest, it sort of became the topic that comes up at all the little after parties and the between sessions. And, hey, are you going to Snowden? And I can't believe Snowden's going to speak at this. I wonder if he's going to say anything interesting. It was the whisper in the hallways, you know, Snowden, Snowden.
Right.
You're walking down the hall.
So you've got these two people from the ACLU on stage doing the interview with Snowden on this video link. What about the people in the room? I mean, do you think they viewed Snowden more as a criminal or as a rock star?
I have to say, Marco, definitely a rock star. There were several moments in the talk when people would get into applause and, you know, there was even cheers at some points. And certainly it plays to Snowden's hand that these are his type of people, the hackers, the groups of people doing net neutrality advocacy. You know, these are all like-minded individuals.
So toward the end, to just give a little illustration of what you're talking about, Snowden was asked if he would do it again, and he answered yes and then added this.
I took an oath to support and defend the Constitution, and I saw that the Constitution was violated on massive scales. The interpretation of the Fourth Amendment had been changed in...
Right, so the Constitution was violated on a massive scale, says Snowden, and lots of applause. Were there any dissenting voices in the crowd, Stephen?
It's hard to say. You know, in a crowd that large, I'm sure some people were looking at it with a very critical eye at what Snowden was saying. But, you know, the ACLU is advocating on behalf of Snowden. And I'd say, you know, definitely the crowd that would support the type of things that Snowden is advocating, with stronger encryption technologies, a stronger look at privacy, and a stronger look at oversight, the things that he was saying that there needs to be oversight, that the public should have some kind of say, and what the NSA are, what they're doing with the mass collection of surveillance and metadata.
For you, what was the most kind of surprising exchange or bit of information that you got out of the session with Edward Snowden?
Well, I have to say Edward had some very strong rhetoric, and, you know, he's in a crowd of people that that are very concerned about the future of the internet and the way that the internet is going and that it's turning into a siloed universe. And the net neutrality crowd is very concerned that, you know, it's just a blip in time, and that the big internet service providers are closing in and working too closely with the NSA. And so he's having a very interesting point of view, and even went on to say that essentially, you know, this is what he's suggesting, that the NSA is setting fire to the future of the internet. And of course, that plays well in the crowd of people building the technologies for a free and interesting and exciting and vibrant internet. They're very concerned about that.
The World's Stephen Davies speaking with us from Austin, Texas, where he attended the session this morning with Edward Snowden on a video link from Russia. Stephen, thanks very much.
Thanks, Marco.
The mystery of Flight 370 continues. 3 days after it disappeared, there's still no sign of the Malaysian Airlines jet. It took off on Friday night from Kuala Lumpur in Malaysia, headed to Beijing. The plane lost radio contact about 45 minutes after takeoff, and there hasn't been much to go on ever since. The World's Matthew Bell has been following the story, and he's in the studio with me. It's been 3 days since Flight 370 went missing, Matthew. What do we know at this point?
Yeah, Marco, amazingly, we just don't know that much other than the basics. There were 227 passengers on board the plane, 12 crew members. The plane took off Friday night, heading toward Beijing, as you mentioned. About 45 minutes later, it lost radio contact, and we just don't know what happened after that. Right now, at least six different nations are helping with search and rescue operations. But as one Malaysian official put it today, he said that it's not looking good in terms of finding the aircraft. At this point, it's a real mystery.
It's speculative at this point, Matthew, but we're also hearing about two men on the plane who were traveling with stolen passports. What else do we know about this?
Malaysian officials say that they're sharing this intelligence and that these two men were traveling, one on an Austrian passport, one on an Italian passport, evidently. This sort of thing happens a lot more than you might think. Thousands of passports in the United States go missing or are stolen or lost every year. In this case, we just don't know if these two men had something to do with the plane going down and disappearing. There's going to be a lot of focus on these two people, where they came from, where they got their tickets. The Financial Times today was reporting that they bought the tickets in Thailand from a travel agency that was dealing with someone from Iran as a middleman. We just don't know, but those are leads that authorities are going to be tracking down.
Now, we've seen the photographs from Beijing of just distraught family members wondering where their passengers and their loved ones are. Very horrifying to see that, and it's going to be a waiting game until anybody finds a black box or some evidence of this aircraft. So what next?
Yeah, for now, it's been a lot of frustration there. Most of the passengers on the plane were from China. There's been scenes of just real anger and confusion in Beijing, where authorities are meeting with family members and friends. Even Chinese officials have expressed frustration, pointed fingers at the Malaysian side, and said that Malaysian authorities need to be more transparent and move more quickly. As for the search operation, they're going to widen the area in the water where they're looking for evidence of the plane going down. They're even going to look on the west side of Malaysia. There's thinking that maybe the plane turned around at some point for some reason, tried to come back toward Kuala Lumpur. There are dozens of boats, dozens of planes involved in this international operation to find out, but it could take time. There was a plane crash in 2009 when a plane went down. In some similar circumstances, it took 2 years for them to find the black box, and that's really what's going to be needed most likely for some definitive answers to these questions.
The World's Matthew Bell, thanks very much.
Thanks, Marco.
More than 100,000 refugees. I'm not talking South Sudan or Congo or Haiti or one of the other many troubled places in the developing world. We're talking Japan now. 100,000 is roughly how many people are still displaced 3 years after disaster struck the country's Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant. That was March 11th, 2011. Neither local communities nor the country's economy as a whole have yet recovered from the events of that day. And some observers say Japan won't recover until it's made some fundamental changes. Here's the World's environment editor, Peter Thompson.
In the weeks after the triple meltdown at the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant, any number of investigations were launched into what went wrong that terrible day. But many of the people doing those inquiries were linked one way or another to the nuclear industry itself, or to Japan's government. So Yoichi Funabashi, a former journalist who once headed one of Japan's leading news organizations, decided what was needed was a truly independent investigation. He gathered up some of Japan's top scientists and academics and launched what they called the Independent Investigation Commission on the Fukushima nuclear accident. Its months of interviews and inquiries found plenty of failures of design and performance behind the meltdowns. But Funabashi says the biggest problem the commission identified wasn't about technology. It was about the culture of what it calls Japan's nuclear village.
Regulators pretended to regulate. The operators pretend to be regulated.
Funabashi describes a closed world of nuclear power plant operators and regulators, one which was not only impervious to public scrutiny and accountability within Japan, but that was also resistant to innovations and new safety technologies from elsewhere in the world. He says within this bubble, the Japanese nuclear village built up a myth of the absolute safety of the country's plants, the firm belief that Japan's reactors were the safest and most advanced in the world. Funabashi says it was a myth that came back to haunt them 3 years ago.
I think they actually have found themselves caught in their own trap.
The time since the Fukushima disaster has brought some important changes to that insular culture. Most significant, Funabashi says, has been the creation of a new, much more independent nuclear regulation authority, which has in turn set much higher standards for safe operation of the country's nuclear plants. But Funabashi says the changes fall far short of what's needed.
I wish that they would have started to change much more radically and fundamentally.
At their root, Funabashi says the problems that led to the Fukushima disaster stem from deep within the larger Japanese culture. He says to truly avoid the same kinds of mistakes in the future, Japan has to open itself up much more to the outside world and to much more diversity and debate within the country.
Japan really has to make its society much more diverse. Too much homogeneous, too much conformist society really has stifled debates and dissenting views.
Even so, Funabashi says, dissenting views within Japan are already starting to change the conversation. He says, for instance, that the government's new plan to restore nuclear power to a prominent role in the country's energy supply is likely to run into significant opposition.
I do not think that we should underestimate that public deep suspicion and mistrust with the Japanese government and the utilities.
Having to do without a lot of nuclear power would mean continued big challenges for Japan. But Funabashi says big economic and demographic changes are already underway in the country. As Japan's young people adjust to an economy of slower growth and lower consumption, he says, 21st century Japan may not need as much energy of any kind as it once did. For The World, I'm Peter Thompson.
Coming up later in the show, we remember the 19th century Ukrainian poet Taras Shevchenko, a man whose words have special resonance in today's crisis-stricken Ukraine.
Bury me, be done with me, rise and break your chain, water your new liberty with blood for rain. Then in the mighty family of all men that are free, maybe sometimes very softly you will speak of me.
This is PRI. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Our series, The Ninth Month, focuses on pregnancy and childbirth around the globe and on what's being done to make the experience safer for both mothers and babies. No matter where a woman lives, pregnancy is rarely easy. But many Russian women say that in their country, it's a lot harder than it needs to be. Julia Barton has our story from Moscow.
Almira Knudsen lives with her husband and three kids in southwestern Moscow. Their youngest child, Aiden, was born a year and a half ago.
The whole pregnancy was stressful.
It was her first childbirth in Moscow.
Just sitting in lines to visit doctors and to give tests, and then just the whole experience.
She says the process felt adversarial. Knudsen's in her 30s. By Russian standards, that's old to have children. And doctors labeled her pregnancy risky. Several doctors urged her to get an abortion, she says, because she'd had a previous C-section, and they thought her scar was too thin. She refused to have an abortion, but says it was hard to find a doctor to agree with her decision. And then at the birthing hospital, there was the issue of money.
They always tell you that medical care is free, and you just pay for room and board.
To get a private room, she paid $4,000, but it didn't buy her much privacy. Other women were crowded into the hallway.
And all the women from hallway were using our bathroom. And it's just the whole system is not really good for women.
And some women say the system isn't good for their babies either. Anastasia Toymyntseva sits in her Moscow apartment with her second child, a toddler. She's relieved he's a healthy boy after her experience with her first pregnancy. She says doctors botched that delivery. The doctors made a mistake, she says. My daughter had a traumatic injury. In the end, her daughter turned out okay, but Toymyntseva says her child spent the next year in and out of the hospital for treatment. Such stories are all too easy to find in Russia. Mothers say there's little concern for their comfort during pregnancy, and the birthing facilities and medical practices can be drastically out of date. Health officials admit that in Soviet times, the medical system was fairly isolated and didn't keep up with the latest advances. But Russian officials say they're working fast to bring the system up to date.
If you want to talk about the overall outlines of the situation here, it's clearly changing for the better.
That's Gennady Sukhich. He directs a large research center and hospital for obstetrics and gynecology in Moscow. It's called the Kulikov Center. On the day I visited, the center was hosting an international medical congress. The halls outside Sukhich's office were packed with representatives of medical device and pharmaceutical companies looking for a bigger share of the Russian market. Upstairs in the delivery ward, it was fairly quiet. No patients in the halls here.
It's the room where they deliver babies.
A large room for delivery stood empty, and nearby, only a few new moms rested in the patient rooms, which featured lacquered furniture and plastic flowers and vases. It may not look like an upscale maternity ward in the U.S., but this Soviet-era facility is at the center of President Vladimir Putin's efforts to improve maternity care. Doctors from all over train here. Director Gennady Sukhich says the government is rapidly bringing Western technology and methods, not just here to Moscow, but to regional centers all across the country. He says they're also trying to provide more patient-centered care.
We're trying to reduce the amount of time patients spend in clinics and to be more effective with that time.
And the government's efforts to improve the quality of maternal care, they are working, says Kirill Danishevsky. He's chief editor of the Journal of Medicine of Russia.
All of the objective indicators such as infant mortality, maternal mortality, rates of objective complications is declining.
That's good news for Russia, which is investing in maternal care for a pressing reason. The country's birth rate plummeted during the collapse of the Soviet Union and hasn't recovered since. One way to keep the population from falling further is to reduce infant mortality. But Danishevsky says actually growing the population is going to be difficult.
Because there's very few things you can do to increase birth rates. Once they are down, it's very hard to make them significantly higher.
To encourage births, the Russian government is offering families stipends of about $10,000 for each child they have beyond the first. Elmira Knutson, the woman who had such an unpleasant experience giving birth to her son Aiden, she applied for a stipend.
I submitted all the documents and then maybe...
She got the stipend, but she says it's not enough to entice her to give birth again in a medical system she says is still too stressful for moms. Next time, she says, she and her husband will adopt.
That's the way we're going to go.
For the World, I'm Julia Barton, Moscow.
You can check out the other stories in our series at pri.org/ninth month. Our next story is about that Cadillac TV ad that's gone viral. You've probably seen it. The one where this guy, actor Neil McDonough, celebrates Americans for working hard and being driven, and also thumbs his nose at Europeans for their short work weeks and long summer vacations. Well, the World's Jerry Haddon broached the subject with some European experts, his in-laws.
I live in Spain, but my house is more like a French enclave. That's Francine and Bob, my in-laws, as they arrive from France this week, unpacking cheeses, gourmet olive oils, pâté. They come about every 2 months and stay for a week, because they can. Bob's retired, and Francine, a public sector employee, has so many days off, she doesn't know what to do with them. So when I told them about this Cadillac ad where an American guy waxes philosophical about work, they got interested.
Why do we work so hard? For what? For this? For stuff?
Okay. Can you translate for Francine?
Pourquoi est-ce que nous travaillons si dur? Pour la piscine? Pour, je ne sais pas quoi, pour le stuff?
Bob translates.
Other countries, they work, they stroll home, they stop by the cafe, they take August off. Off. Why aren't you like that? Why aren't we like that?
Je travaille 180.
I actually work 195 days a year, Francine says. Between French holidays and vacation days, she's got more than 12 weeks off. In other words, a week off every month. And that's just the kind of work ethic that keeps Europeans soft, at least in Mr. Cadillac's view.
Why aren't we like that? Because we're crazy, driven, hard-working believers, that's why. Those other countries think we're nuts. Whatever. Were the Wright brothers insane? Bill Gates, Les Paul, Ali.
Bob's shaking his head. This way of thinking is so materialistic, he says. The only important things are the things you own.
Were we nuts when we pointed to the moon? That's right. We went up there. You know what we got? Ford.
The chest-thumping rant just confuses my in-laws, which is pretty understandable.
But I digress. It's pretty simple. You work hard, you create your own luck, and you gotta believe anything is possible. As for all the stuff, that's the upside of only taking 2 weeks off in August. N'est-ce pas?
C'est dommage. Pour moi, c'est dommage. Si c'est ça, effectivement, le schéma de pensée...
What a shame, Francine says. What a shame, if that's his way of thinking and his purpose in life.
On ne parle pas d'art, on ne parle pas de culture, on ne parle pas de...
He doesn't talk about art, Bob says, or culture, or anything else.
Je m'en fous d'avoir une piscine, je préfère...
I couldn't give a you-know-what about owning a pool, Francine says. I prefer walking on the beach, and as for the car, it just needs to run well, to get me to a place where I can park it and go for a walk. So there you have it, a little European spunk to even the score. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon in Barcelona.
This is PRI. I'm Marco Werman. Ahead, trying to bridge the divide between Christians and Muslims in the Nigerian city of Kaduna.
You literally have the river Kaduna and a bridge that separates the north from the south. And you really literally have, right there on the 10th parallel, is the dividing line between these two faiths.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, searching for runners who benefit from medical technology to run in the Medtronic Twin Cities Marathon or Medtronic 10-mile run. Application and information available at medtronic.com/globalheroes.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. Over the weekend, rallies were held across Ukraine to remember the man who wrote these words.
Bury me, be done with me, rise and break your chain, water your new liberty with blood for rain. Then in the mighty family of all men that are free, maybe sometimes very softly you will speak of me.
The final lines of The Testament by Ukrainian poet Taras Shevchenko. Yesterday would have been his 200th birthday, and his words resonate strongly with many Ukrainians now during the crisis with Russia. But Taras Shevchenko is also hardwired to the Ukrainian soul. That's what Ukrainian writer Andrei Kurkov says, and he, by the way, read Shevchenko's poem for us.
He's a great poet in Ukrainian. He wrote also in Russian poetry, but his Ukrainian poetry, his Ukrainian language became the basis for Ukrainian literary language, for Ukrainian literature. He was a serf. He was actually a slave who had a very difficult destiny. He became also some kind of symbol for uprising, for the desire to be free for the whole of Ukraine.
So give us a quick bio. I know he was born about 200 years ago. Who is he?
Well, he was born in Kyiv's region as a serf to the landowner Engelgard. He lost his mother, I think, when he was 7 or 8 years old. And when he was 12, his father died. He wanted to learn, but of course, I mean, there was no school, so he was helped by a local monk. At some point, he started going to monks who were painting icons to help them, and he learned basics of painting or drawing from them. And for many people, actually, he is also a very great artist.
When Shevchenko started writing poetry, what kind of topics did he deal with?
He started writing poetry very early. It was always poems about Ukraine, about difficult destiny of Ukrainian men and women, about his beloved Ukraine, which is not independent, which is controlled by Moscow. And you can find lots of lines in his poems against Moscow and, of course, against the Tsar.
When you talk about the difficult destiny that he kind of talked about in his poetry for Ukrainian men and women, what did he mean?
They are all slaves. They have to serve to Germans, to Russians, to Moscow's Tsar, and they cannot be happy because they are not free.
Is that a view of Ukrainians that you think Ukrainians still think is valid today?
Well, of course, I mean, it's not legitimate view anymore. But in today's situation with Russia occupying Crimea, the poems of Shevchenko get the new, which is also the old meaning, that Moscow is trying to dominate and to control destiny of Ukraine. Of course, I mean, he remains a father figure for Ukrainian nation, a spiritual father. But also, I mean, he was a spiritual father for Ukrainian nation in the Soviet time. The Soviet ideologists recognized him as the most important poet of Ukraine. He was taught in the schools. Children had to learn his poetry by heart. At the same time, on the 9th of March every year, the KGB officers and police would control who will lay flowers to his monuments all around Ukraine, because it was considered that the nationalists and Ukrainian anti-Soviet activists would go with flowers to his monuments, and the pro-Soviet Ukrainian intelligentsia would gather in philharmonic halls or in opera houses to commemorate with the Communist Party.
He died, interestingly, Andrei Kurkov, at a young age, 47. And the story of his burial, I gather, is highly symbolic in Ukraine today.
He died in St. Petersburg, having planned actually to return to Ukraine. He was dreaming about coming back to Ukraine. And then actually when he died, his body was carried from St. Petersburg to Kyiv. It was definitely a very symbolic act because, of course, there were lots of stops overnight. And all the places where the body laid became at that time some kind of shrines. In the very center of Kyiv, just 20 meters from Maidan, where we had the pro-European protests, there is a small house also dedicated to him, which is also now part of his museum.
Just getting briefly back to those rallies yesterday, Andrei Kurkov, there are reports of violence at the rally in Sevastopol commemorating Shevchenko, reports of attacks by Cossacks even. What do you make of this latest news?
I mean, Moscow was also publicly sort of celebrating his anniversary, but at the same time, the Russian government yesterday announced that Taras Shevchenko, were alive, would not like today's Ukraine and today's Ukrainian politicians and their actions. Of course, I mean, his figure probably provokes hatred because it is so powerful and because it is used by the Ukrainians so much these days.
Andrei Kurkov, a Ukrainian writer living in Kyiv, thank you very much for your thoughts on Taras Shevchenko. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
If you're a skier or a snowboarder, you probably have a mental map of where the best slopes are. Well, I bet the place we're about to tell you about is not on that map. First off, it's in Afghanistan, more war zone than winter sports destination. In Bamiyan, to be exact, where the Taliban famously destroyed two massive Buddha statues years ago. None of that has stopped the organizers of the Afghan Ski Challenge, held annually since 2011 in central Afghanistan. The BBC's Kaun Hamush took part in this year's edition.
So we was in Bamiyan. The Ski Challenge was held in 2 days. The first day was for boys, and the second day was for girls exclusive. It was my first time joining a ski challenge. I was actually only for covering the story, but I stand on a ski and had a small experience of skiing in Bamiyan hillsides.
This was a competitive skiing event in Bamiyan, is that right?
Yeah, it was almost 60 ski competitors. 30 of them was Afghans and 20 other were foreigners, the tourists and the other foreigners who live in Afghanistan. They joined the race and they had a competition.
Where is the nearest fighting or conflict taking place to Bamiyan?
Yeah, the security inside Bamiyan is very good. It's a very secure province among the central provinces of Afghanistan, but the border and the neighbor cities like Wardak City and Baghlan City are insecure, lots of insurgents, and sometimes Taliban members are in the route, and they stop people, they avoid people to travel, and they make troubles. But in Bamyan, because of its security, women and girls can join a ski challenge and can go to school, can work, and can do anything they want.
Did you speak with any of those women who've been skiing? I mean, do they like it?
Yeah, I had a short interview with the winner of the girls' race. She was very happy. She started a ski race in Bamyan last year. She joined classes of training, and she is happy now for being a amateur skier as a girl in Bamyan.
So she's from Bamyan, this girl. What's her name?
Yeah, she's in Bamyan. Her name is Masuma.
Describe the mountain where these skiing events are taking place. What's the snow condition there?
Yeah, the weather in Bamyan is often very cold. Bamyan has snow-covered mountains during winter, and Iski Challenge took place near the Kuhe Baba. It's a mountain. Its name is Baba Mountain. It was not that high, but when we tried to get up to the hill, we just walked up almost 30 minutes and we reached there.
So no ski lift, rope tow, or gondola. You walk up the mountain to ski down. Is that it?
Yeah, no lifts. We just walked with our equipment and until we reached to the start point. I didn't have any experience of skiing in Bamyan. I just tried and stand on the ski and come down, and I left down, and lots of Afghans don't have experience of skiing. And these organizations and these competitions are trying to push Afghanistan toward the winter sports like ski and snowboarder.
Did you have fun at least skiing?
Yeah, it was great. I feel cold in the snow until my feet, and it was very cold there. But it was a good experience for me, and I had lots of fun there.
The BBC's Kaoun Khamush, who recently went downhill skiing for the first time in Bamyan in central Afghanistan. Thanks so much for telling us about it, Kaoun. Great to meet you.
Thank you very much. Have a good day.
Let's shift gears here. Now, it's a horrifying thought, but nearly 4 months after Typhoon Haiyan hit in the Philippines, the bodies of the dead are still turning up nearly every day. It's hard to imagine what that's like, but one thing is for sure, it makes it really hard for people to put the storm behind them. So now a team of American cadaver dogs and their trainers is in Tacloban to do a final sweep of the hard-hit city. Reporter Aurora Amandral joined them on a search.
Hey.
We're walking through mud and brush along the shore in Tacloban. You can see wrecked cars still out in the bay. In the sand are broken trees and household stuff. Pillows, shaving cream, dolls' heads, tablecloths.
I know you remember what to do. Get ready. You ready? Go find it.
That's Jim Houck with his black lab, Patella. Houck is a firefighter from Denver, and it's his third time in Tacloban since the storm. He and Patella specialize in finding human remains after disasters. This neighborhood,
Barangay 88, has the longest list of missing persons on it. And so we wanted to come start here and see what we can maybe put a dent in that list for people.
Patella is splashing in the water and sniffing around. Houck says when the storm surge came through here, it washed over the entire peninsula, sweeping thousands of people a mile and a half over the bay and into downtown Tacloban. When the water pulled back, it brought with it dead bodies. Months later, some of them may still be tangled in tree roots or tucked into the coves of the beach.
Oh, I know, she's not.
Houck puts a lot of work into training Patella so she can dive right into a disaster zone.
Not around that point, is it?
Cadaver dogs like her can maneuver through the destruction.
Climb underneath a collapsed building, climb into the rubble, into a void, climb a ladder.
They can sniff out the bodies swept into the bay.
I know of dogs that have located remains under 40 feet of water.
And they can smell the difference between a dead pig or chicken under the rubble or a human body. Houck says these dogs can even find human remains more than a century old.
Wait, they can smell out a body that died in like 1802?
Yeah. There's dogs that are trained for that. It is. It's good.
But every job brings its own challenges. Immediately after the disaster in Tacloban, the entire city smelled of death. Houck said it was confusing for Patella.
Well, here it wasn't a single body. A lot of times, as we spoke, there was more than one, and that was something new for her. It took her a day or two to get over that overwhelming scent and be able to continue to work. So it's constantly learning.
So how many have Patella and the other dogs found?
I don't keep track. I don't count. There's a lot.
Doing this job, he comes into contact with hundreds of bodies in every state of decomposition. Hauk says he gets through it by remembering that each time they find remains, they're helping with the recovery effort.
And there's also the emotional side of, like I said, the 6-year-old and the 8-year-old, you know, out playing with the ball, go to chase the ball and come across, you know, a set of remains.
But mostly, it's for the survivors. Joel Aradana lives in this seaside neighborhood. He was separated from his wife and 2 children during the storm and never saw them again. You might think that 4 months after a disaster like this, a person would start to accept that their missing loved ones have died. But it doesn't always work that way. Of course, I'm longing for them, he says. I haven't lost hope that they'll return. He believes that at least one of them must still be alive. Aradana doesn't feel much like talking and sits back down on his hammock. But his uncle Mansueto tells me he's happy to know that the cadaver dogs are out there, searching. Mansueto says if they can be found or retrieved, that would already be a big deal. It's for this reason that Hauk is volunteering a month of his time, leaving his wife and kids behind in Denver, to give people like Aradana some certainty, some relief from the unknown.
There's always that hope. Even if there's just a little chance that somebody may be alive, and if we can help those people move on, all the other devastation they're going to have to deal with in their lives being affected by this typhoon, to take that one more thing away and let them move on from that would be, you know, definitely helpful.
That's a bark alert. Bibi, one of the other cadaver dogs, has picked up a scent. It's down a steep embankment in the roots of a mangrove tree. They mark the spot on their GPS and with a piece of neon yellow tape. Later, Tacloban's fire department will get out their boats to retrieve the remains. And one survivor will be a step closer to finding closure.
Patella, you ready? Go find.
For the world, I'm Aurora Almendral, Tacloban.
PRI.org is our online home when we're not on the radio, but there are other ways to find the world, like Flipboard. This app takes our radio show and turns it into a magazine. Our stories turn into pages that you can flip through, but you can play the stories and hear all the voices you know from the world. A great thing, and it runs on your iPad, iPhone, or Android device. Find it at flip.it/PRI. Again, that's flip.it/PRI. This is PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Lumosity.com, a brain training program designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 50 million people worldwide. More at Lumosity.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Much of the news we Americans hear about Nigeria is about religious violence. In recent years, thousands of people have been killed there in the name of religion. Hundreds have already been killed just in 2014. But there are also glimmers of a peace movement. Charles Sennett of our partner Global Post recently met a remarkable pair of Nigerian religious figures at an interfaith meeting in the northern city of Kaduna.
The city of Kaduna and the state of Kaduna is really a microcosm for Nigeria as a whole, right? So Nigeria is the most populous nation in Africa. It's also the largest nation in the world to have a population that's approximately 50% Muslim and 50% Christian. That line of Muslims predominantly to the north, Christians predominantly to the south, is very sharp in the middle belt in Kaduna. You literally have the river Kaduna and a bridge that separates the north from the south. And you really literally have right there on the 10th parallel is the dividing line between these two faiths. And unfortunately, a great history of clashing of these faiths and a lot of violence. So Kaduna is both right at the heart of the conflict between Muslims and Christians in Nigeria. But interestingly, these days, it's also very much a place where there is a lot going on in terms of interfaith work and in terms of reconciliation.
So major tension and periodic flare-ups of violence between Christians and Muslims in Kaduna in northern Nigeria. Now, you meet this pastor and an imam who seem on the verge of coming together. Physically, they hadn't met. I want you to take us to that moment where they're actually in the same room and an intermediary kind of walks them together. What happens?
Well, the pastor and the imam are really these fundamentalists. They would use that word. They're fundamentalist leaders. Pastor James is a fundamentalist Christian, very much an evangelical church, very strong, Pat Robertson influenced, very much in that tradition. Imam Ashafa is very much a fundamentalist himself, very much influenced by the Salafists, very, very adamant, very militant.
And basically at a certain point in their lives, they're telling their congregants to kind of go after each other, right?
In the 90s, they led militias. As young men, they were leading these militias of militancy to say there is going to be a clash between Christians and Muslims and we need to defend our faith. And they even targeted each other.
Right. The imam had the pastor's hand cut off.
Yeah. So the imam sent out his gang to attack the pastor and his gang. And in that clash, yes, you're exactly right. Pastor James' hand was severed by a machete and he now has a prosthesis. The imam was also the target of attacks. The pastor James had sent out his boys to go after the imam and his men. And they killed two of the imam's cousins, and they also killed his great mentor, an Islamic cleric who was a, you know, real mentor to the imam. So both men had suffered, as have so many people in Nigeria and so many people in this crystallized, very intense emotional fault line between Muslims and Christians in Kaduna. So they embodied that, but they also embodied the path towards reconciliation in that they began very long, slow story over many, many years about listening to messages about reconciliation, that you can't possibly be a good Muslim if you have hatred in your heart for anyone, especially Christians who are people of the book. And the Pastor James similarly came to a realization that he is not a Christian if he's holding hatred in his heart for brothers.
I want you to not lose us in that moment, though, where they meet and the intermediary says, yeah. What does he say? I got shivers on my spine when
yeah,
I heard this.
Yeah, it's a beautiful scene, really, where they're both experiencing this conversion within themselves, but they don't trust it and there's no real grounding there yet. But a journalist who was with them, pulled together by the government to bring a lot of people together to address the violence, walked up to them quickly. He was a respected figure, and he said to both of them, you two alone can stop the violence here. You need to talk to each other. And he just walked away. And they were left in this silence, a distance of a few feet, as Pastor James put it, but miles and miles apart. And they began a discussion and a dialogue that eventually led to true reconciliation. And they are now a duo. They are now the pastor and the imam. They have a television show. They take their show on the road. They really have a spirit of brothers, and they have a deep past of conflict, and they've worked it out. And I think they've tried to hold themselves up as a model for what the country can do if it can get to that spirit of forgiveness, get into the messages of reconciliation within both faiths, and stop the violence. And I think they've been real leaders in this regard. It was thrilling to watch them in action.
And yet, as you well know, the violence in Nigeria continues. We had this incident about 10 days ago with these schoolboys in a dormitory who were massacred by some Boko Haram offshoot. Does the imam, for example, or any religious officials in Nigeria have the ear of groups like Boko Haram and its violent offshoots?
The imam does have the ear of some people who are affiliated with Boko Haram. Boko Haram is a very broad, ill-defined movement. It literally means Western education is blasphemy or a sin. That's why they're attacking schools. They're targeting schools that are seen as Western influenced. So the imam wouldn't know kind of the leaders of Boko Haram, but he would know people who are inspired by some of its very hateful teachings. And he's tried to work very closely to, as he would put it, deprogram them. It's really about getting them to get closer to messages of reconciliation that are within their faiths. And we saw great and practical experiences that were very productive there.
A glimmer of light in a pretty grim situation in Nigeria, the pastor and the imam there. We have a video of the pastor and the imam talking about their attempts to kill each other as well as their reconciliation. That's at PRI.org. Charlie Sennett with our friends at Global Post. Thank you.
Thank you, Marco.
They may not be ready for it yet in Kaduna, but when they are, a British-Nigerian singer by the name of Eno Williams has some advice that may help with Muslim-Christian harmony. Dance. Eno Williams fronts Ibibio Sound Machine. The Ibibio are one of Nigeria's many ethnic groups. They're from southeast Nigeria. Ibibio Sound Machine, however, you'd find them in London. As lead vocalist, Eno Williams also writes many of the band's lyrics. And some of those lyrics come from her grandmother in Nigeria. She used to recount old Ibibio folktales to Eno Williams when the singer was a child. Not much Ibibio culture, though, in the band's single, Let's Dance. But with its retro disco beats, it's still a groovy tune. We close with Ibibio Sound Machine today from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Follow me on Twitter and Instagram. I'm at Marco Werman, and the show is at PRI The World. Thank you for listening.
Is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH, supported by the National Endowment for the Arts, by Nan and Bill Harris, committed to supporting objective, unbiased reporting on national and international issues, by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs and their innovations to solve the world's most pressing problems at skoll.org, the Ford Foundation, the Luce Foundation's Henry R. Luce Initiative on Religion and International Affairs, by the PRI Trust for Innovation, which enables informed risk-taking in the creation of new content for public radio. Donors to the trust include Peter and Catherine Darrow, the Tagney-Jones Family Fund, and the Rose Family Fund. And by the PRI Ambassador Council, whose members include John and Caroline Ballantyne, Blythe Brendan Mann Foundation, and Michael V. and Ann Cerisi.
PRI, Public Radio International.